Hello, my name is Susie DeJong, speaker, coach, and author of The Untangling. And this is the Untangling series podcast, where we untangle our own unseen and unspoken chains that bind us to open up the way for us to experience more joy and peace and healing than we ever thought possible. So come and join me. Put on your comfiest clothes, grab a cup of something hot, or maybe even a glass of something bubbly. Put your feet up and let the untangling begin. Welcome to the next episode of the Untangling series podcast. I am so glad you have joined me again today, and I'm really thrilled to introduce a most amazing woman with a most amazing story. Her name is Ruby Mitchell. Ruby and I met back in 2018 when we were both fellow graduates of Rapid Transformational Therapy, also known as RTT, a therapy created by UK psychotherapist Marissa Peer. Ruby is a trained psychotherapist, clinical hypnotherapist, advanced RTT therapist, family trauma specialist, and a dedicated trauma specialist. That's a lot to have on your CV, isn't it? Widely regarded as an expert in self-guided healing and trauma recovery, Ruby is also a board member of the Australian Society of Clinical Hypnotherapists. Her rapidly transforming trauma program has helped thousands of childhood trauma survivors and survivors of other types of trauma worldwide to completely transform their lives. Ruby's own story began in her early 20s when she was dealing with not one, but two rare debilitating genetic illnesses. This led her down the path of investigating her family tree to find out more about it. What she then discovered turned Ruby's life and her view of her own self-identity upside down and started her on her own journey of healing from trauma. Once on this journey, Ruby just knew deep in her heart that she wanted to support others who had experienced similar childhood traumas or other types of traumas, including those suffering with PTSD. This is Ruby's story. Okay, so I'm very, very excited to have as a special guest on the Untangling podcast an amazing lady who I am just so grateful that she accepted to come on the program today, because I know there are so many people out there that will resonate with Ruby. And I've done a little bit of introduction beforehand to fill you in on Ruby's background. And here we have the beautiful lady in person. Ruby's up in Toowoomba, or on the outskirts of Toowoomba, and I'm down here on the Gold Coast, so we're not too far away. But I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you so much, Ruby, for joining me today.
Thank you, Susie. It's such a pleasure to be here, and it's such a treat to be working with someone in the same time zone, right?
Absolutely. Well, it makes it easier, doesn't it?
It does.
So I would love you to share a little bit about, I guess, how you got into working in the field of trauma. As much as you feel comfortable with sharing, I'll just leave that up to you. But if you could just explain a little bit about how that all began for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. So I think my experience is actually similar to many people who choose to specialize in this field, in that it is what I lived through and worked through and healed myself. And when I got to that place where I actually felt there had been significant change and a level of freedom. I was so excited and so inspired to be able to help other people get to that place as well. So for me, I grew up knowing that I was raised in a pretty dysfunctional family. And I mistakenly thought that if I grew up and moved away and ceased contact, that that would be the end of it. And as many of us who have walked this path know, that is not the way it works. So geographical and physical distance doesn't actually undo the damage that was done. And so for me, my trauma really presented in the form of physical ailments. So when I was 21, I developed a tumor in my skull and I had to go down and have quite a radical surgery at that time. I had a 3.5-inch piece of my skull here on the left that was removed, and I have a polymer resin plug that's in place. And when they did the testing initially, they told me that it was a very rare genetic condition. And so not only was this a huge thing to be going through physically, but it was also the start of my emotional unraveling in terms of realizing that the family that I was raised in were not necessarily my biological family. And so then I had about a 14-year period where I had significant illness, because what we didn't know at the time was that the tumor was actually a form of Langerhans cell histiocytosis, which is a recurrent cancer that can show up anywhere in your body. So for that 14, 15-year period, I would be really, really sick. And then I would go through and we would deal with the problem and I'd be okay and I'd be in remission. But that remission would only last for 6 to 9 months at a time. So it was this really awful long period of being in the trenches and literally fighting for survival. And at the time, right at the very beginning when this happened, someone suggested that I might need to speak with a psychologist. And I was so deeply offended, because to me, this was clearly a physical issue and had nothing to do with my childhood. And I had no interest or desire to speak about any of that whatsoever. Obviously, as time progressed and I grew a little bit older and I realized things were not improving on their own, I did eventually seek treatment, and I was in therapy for quite a few years. And then it was around 2014, I had a really traumatic triggering experience. So I was standing in line at a grocery store, and I have a very heightened sense of smell. And what I didn't know at the time was that the person who had sexually assaulted me when I was a child was 2 cash registers over, and I smelt him before I saw him or recognized him at all. And I had this absolutely overwhelming physical response. My body just went into shutdown, and it was both terrifying and incredibly embarrassing. But it was really a turning point for me, because that was the point when I went, okay, I can't keep pretending that everything was okay. And that was around the same time that I was diagnosed with complex PTSD. And I was really frustrated, because I sat in that therapist's office, and when I got the diagnosis, I didn't know what that meant. I had no idea of what that diagnosis meant to someone outside of military experience. That was the only place I'd really had any knowledge about PTSD. And when I asked the therapist, okay, so what does that mean now? What do I do moving forward? And she just sort of had a little chuckle and went, oh, darling, you're going to be in therapy for the rest of your life.
Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
I did not handle that well.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. And that was, wow. I'm pretty sure that was 2014, yeah. So the other part of me is that I have a bit of a rebellious nature, and I tend to fight back when people tell me what to do. And so I did. I had that little moment where I went, oh, because I literally, She said to me at a later stage, she said, oh, that's great. We were thinking about putting a tennis court in the backyard. And I was like, oh, I was so offended on so many levels. But I appreciate that now, because that was the moment that I went, oh, no. I am not going to, I'm not going to be in therapy for the rest of my life. Although, to be fair, I have been in therapy since then, but on the other side of the coin, because that was the moment that I went, I am going to learn absolutely everything that I can possibly learn about this condition and treating this condition and what is required to actually heal from this condition. And it did take a few more years before I got to that place and I put all the missing puzzle pieces in, because I was then in this situation where I had all the knowledge and I had the understanding, and I didn't quite yet know how to put it into practice. And so for me, that piece really came when I went to London and trained with Marissa Peer, because that was the first time that I saw really significant improvements and changes, obviously within myself, but then to be able to bring that back and share that with clients and see those phenomenal changes in them, that was incredible as well. But for me, I had to understand it theoretically and logically, but I also had to know what it was to heal from it as well.
I find that so interesting, you know, and I feel sorry for that psychologist that was her limited understanding, but, you know, that's obviously what she was trained in. I had a similar comment made by a beautiful woman that I interviewed a few years back, who was a police officer, and also unknowingly through all the experiences that she'd had, obviously very confrontational experiences, had unfortunately developed PTSD as well. And the comment that she said to me was the same as what you just said, Ruby. I thought that only happened to people in the military. And I also said to her, well, isn't that something that, you know, that you're educated in the police force, so you know the signs to look for? And she said no. And there was a stigma attached to it. So even
absolutely
now, you know, and even more as a female, unfortunately. But it astounds me, the lack of understanding about PTSD. And, you know, it's not, we don't always like putting labels on things, do we? I mean, you're feeling, you're going through what you're going through. But getting an explanation like that kind of is, I don't know, what would you say? It's a relief, because you feel like, I'm not going mad. Is that how you feel?
I think for a lot of people it could be a relief.
Yeah.
It wasn't a relief for me. It did explain a lot of things, but for me, I just felt like, oh, now this is a challenge that I have to overcome, because that's my personality. But I did, I just before I received the diagnosis, I remember I had dropped my kids at school and I was driving in the car and I completely dissociated. And I had that moment when I realized that it was dangerous, that what I was experiencing was really, really dangerous, because I was able to pull my car to the side of the road. But beyond that, I was not in my body or attached to my body or anywhere to deal with it. So my mind was obviously really struggling to process this incredible depth of information that had just been dumped upon it. And it was good for me to get that diagnosis, because it made me realize how serious it was, that it was not just a little thing here or a little thing there, which is kind of how I felt like it was. Or on the other side of it, I felt like I should have just been coping better. I felt like, you know, I'm a strong woman, I'm very independent, I'm, you know, I like to think of myself as rather intelligent. And it was really frustrating for me that these things were happening that were beyond my control and that I couldn't just white knuckle my way through it. But receiving that diagnosis allowed me to understand why I wasn't able to just persevere and get through it.
And that must have been terrifying, that moment where you dissociated. I've had a similar thing years ago when I was had a bit of a breakdown. It was just like the world was going on around me and I was watching it, but I wasn't a part of it. It is terrifying, but I guess it's a wake-up call, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's, I think, one of the real challenges that those of us who have experienced childhood trauma have is that we normalize these experiences. Because we've been doing it or experiencing it for such a long time, and it is that it is a coping mechanism, but it's not a healthy coping mechanism. However, we don't always give it the level of importance that it should have, because to us that's just normal. And quite often it's not until someone makes a comment that you then go, oh, maybe that's not really normal. Because I know for me growing up, I was very aware that my family was dysfunctional, but I was not aware to the degree of the dysfunction that we were living in. I thought everybody dealt with these things. And so it was really quite shocking to me as a teenager, when I started to go to my friends' houses and realize that people didn't speak to each other in that way and they didn't behave in that way. And it was perfectly normal to be in someone's house for 24 hours without anyone having an explosive, violent outburst. That was so normal in my childhood that I thought that was the way it was for everyone.
And you think too that children, it's a natural thing in children to feel somehow that they're responsible for things that are going on around them. What Absolutely. Do you think that is?
Ooh, that is a really good question, Suze. I think it's because kids think everything is their fault. Kids live in that little solar, that universe where they are the center of everything. Mm. And if they are the center of everything, then they have to be impacting everything. And therefore, their behavior and their whatever they're doing has to be the reason that other things are happening outside of that. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think,
it's tragic though, isn't it, really? Because,
yeah.
Wow.
It is. It's really tragic. And I think it's such a shame, because I think kids should be able to live in that world where they are the center of the universe, because they are. But life tends to teach us that that's not the way it is. So I think it's so heartbreaking when that shatters, that illusion is destroyed, and so much negativity and so much hurt comes from being essentially told that you're not important, that you're not the center of the universe, that your opinion doesn't matter. So much comes from that. And so many people lose their voice and they lose their confidence and they lose that sense of self that I think all children are entitled to have. That's the way we are structured.
Yeah, it's really sad, isn't it? I can see it and understand it. And obviously that's the kind of people that you're helping now navigate those things, those stories that they've told themselves. Tell me, how long do you feel that you got to a point through your self-work and working with other people supporting you that you really felt you got to a place that you had more freedom from your experiences as a child?
Oh, look, it was night and day for me. I did so much work before going to London and I really hadn't had any resolution. Mm-hmm. So I would often go into therapy and I would come out and I would feel worse and I would basically ride a roller coaster of emotion between that appointment and the next appointment. And there wasn't any real traction or positive movement. It was just rehashing things that I didn't want to talk about or didn't want to really think about, but without getting any improvement from that situation or distance from that situation. And that was where, when I went over to London and I did the RTT course and I got to work with Marissa Peer, it was a couple of things. It changed my life dramatically. And it changed my life. I was really fortunate in that I did get to work with Marissa and we did do a couple of different sessions. But also just in the back and forth with the sessions that I was doing with other students, so many incredible life-changing discoveries came out of sessions as we were learning to do this modality. And that was incredible. So I remember, so that's how my name came to be. So Ruby is the name that my biological mother gave me. And obviously I was raised under another name. And I had known maybe for about 2 years before I went to London. Maybe a few more years. I'd known that that was not my real name. And I had this really burning urge to change my name, but I couldn't pick a name. You think it would be really easy, but when you're actually faced with this prospect, it's impossible. Well, for me, it was impossible to just choose something. And so it was always at the back of my mind that I wanted to change my name. And then during this session, which was with another student, we went back and we actually reviewed just after I was born. So it was because my mother died, you know, a few hours after I was born. And it was that scene of seeing her and the woman that was with her, and they were talking about me as a little newborn baby, and they were arguing about what to call me. And the one thing that they could both agree on was the Ruby, but they wanted different second names. So from that next day, so we had this session in class and it was amazing. Then we all went out for drinks afterwards that night and we were talking about it. So I was talking about it because it was beautiful and lovely to have that knowledge. And obviously the woman who had done the session was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And we were all talking about it. And then we came into class the next day and one of the women came up and scrubbed out my name on my name tag and wrote Ruby. And from that very first day, the people who knew me and loved me started referring to me as Ruby. And I was calling in and talking to my family every day while I was away. And had told this story to my husband and he changed my name in his phone. So then when I rang in and I was talking to my kids and they were in the car, they said, oh, I love your new name, Mummy. And I went, oh, how do you know about that? And they said, oh, no, we can see it on the phone. I was like, oh, that's so gorgeous. But it was so that was all of these massive changes happened in a really short period of time. And it was taking that new information and really embracing it and living it fully. So it was about 6 months later that I legally changed my name. But it was really beautiful. And that was such a profound moment for me to be able to reclaim my true name and also to have this deep connection to my biological mother, who I didn't have the chance to have a relationship with her in this, you know, in the physical sense in this life. Yeah. But through lots of these sessions, lots of different sessions that have been done, I have been able to not just piece together the parts that make sense and allow me to understand the story, but I've been able to review scenes and to access knowledge that has given me a really strong emotional connection to that, to my story, to my experience, to my origin, where previously all I had were question marks and the unknown. And that was really difficult to live through, that period where when I discovered that they weren't my biological family, and then it was just this massive unknown, all of this information that I didn't have and I didn't understand and I couldn't put the pieces together. And yet at the same time to know that all of that information was actually stored in my brain and I simply needed to find a way to gain access to that.
Yeah.
That was amazing. So, yes, my trip to London was the transformative moment in my life.
Oh, totally understand. It was a catalyst.
Yeah. And it was almost like a cascade of information because I went there knowing such a tiny fraction of my story and I came back knowing more than I ever imagined I could possibly uncover. So it was beautiful.
Oh, I'm just so glad that it just fills my heart up that you had that experience. It's just so amazing. And you deserved it. You really deserved it.
Thank you. And so, as you can imagine, when I got back from London, I was like, this stuff is amazing.
Yes, well, that's the same reason I did it too. And it's so interesting. And I'm sure that we're not alone, is that a lot of people that train in, you know, psychology or therapy or counselling or whatever it is because they want to heal themselves first. That's what they go looking for. So Absolutely. Where did you, after going through that experience and learning RTT, which is Rapid Transformational Therapy, I haven't said that out loud for people that don't know, when was the moment that you thought, I need to help others, I need for others to experience what I've gone through?
Well, strangely enough, it was before I even left. So when I did my course with Marissa, RTT wasn't really a thing. It was just a little add-on. So I came and did my course and we were learning rapid transformational hypnotherapy. And from the very first moment that I started investigating this, I absolutely knew that this was going to be the right choice. I remember we were living in a house down on the South Coast, and I had cancer again at that stage, and it was really overwhelming. And I'd just been for a PET scan. And back then, PET scans were pretty heavy duty. So that's a scan that they do to detect any cancer that's in your body. And it was, even the experience of having the scan back then was quite traumatic because it was very isolating, and even the technicians were all pretty much done up in nuclear hazard gear. They were on the other side. They would feed the tube in through the wall, and it was all very clinical and cold. You weren't allowed to watch a TV or look at a book or do anything. You just had to be in the room and let this infusion go in. And you also had to sign a risk of death because the procedure was so hardcore. And the day that I had my PET scan, so LCH, Langerhans-Cell histiocytosis, is very, very rare. And so there's a very small community of people in the world who are now gratefully connected. And at the same day that I was having my scan, a little girl over in the United States was having her scan. And so I came back, and obviously I had my scan and I came out of it and I was exhausted, but I was fine. But I came home to the news that she didn't survive, and it absolutely, yeah, that's exactly right. It just tore my heart apart. And I was so grateful because this condition affects children far more than it affects adults. So it was unusual that when I had my initial diagnosis, I was 21. But I had this moment and I was sitting there and I was feeling really sorry for myself. And I was doing that. I cannot keep doing this. This is so exhausting. And just happened to be that was the very first night that I watched a Marissa Peer video on YouTube. And she was talking about you are enough. And oh my God, just that concept, that very, very simple concept that you are enough as you are right now, exactly as you are at this time in this space. That was the first moment that I went, oh, this is my woman. Like, this is the person that I need to train with. And at that stage, she wasn't training. She wasn't teaching anyone. So I was pretty excited when I did obviously get the email to say that she was going to be training people, and took myself off to London at the very first opportunity that was available to me. It was profound. So before I left, I knew what qualification I would come back with, and I already had my business cards printed up the week before I left. And I had my first client booked before I even went to London. I was in the nail salon and I was getting, you know, ready to go over to London, and a lady two seats down from me, she said, oh, did you say hypnotherapy? And I said, yes, I did. And she was like, oh, I'd love to try that. And I slid my little card over and I said, well, I'll be back in about 4 weeks. Give me a call and we'll, you know, get you sorted. And it was really amazing to have that. Like, before I even went, I knew that there were people who were interested. And then obviously I was sharing a lot at that stage via Facebook, which I don't do anymore, but at that stage I did. And I was kind of sharing this whole experience and the journey, and it was beautiful and it was exciting and it was inspiring for a lot of people. So when I got back, I was busy. I was busy quite early. And then it was sort of, it was a journey where I decided that I wanted to specialize more in childhood trauma, because that was really my experience, was that trauma that existed from my childhood, as opposed to things that had happened and caused that trauma as adults. So, yeah, that was a bit of that.
Yeah. Well, I felt the same as you. I actually saw that same video of You Are Enough, and that's how I went down that path. And I guess too, when you do work in the field of therapy, whatever that looks like, it's just astounding, I think is the only word I could use, of how many people have experienced abuse as as children or young adults, in all forms, sexual, you know, violence, emotional, and it's really, it's nearly every one in two people that you come across. Yeah. And it's so how do you define trauma? How would you define trauma? Because there's so many different forms of trauma.
There absolutely are. So in my definition, trauma is anything that has a profound impact on the psyche. So something that changes the way that your mind and your body respond to a situation, because everyone, we can all be exposed to a situation, and yet people will react and respond differently. And so we can have a situation where, you know, say three or four people are exposed to an awful car accident, and you might have one person who just bounces through it and it's something that happened and it's not a problem. You might have another person who they are quite shaken by the experience and they have quite a strong trauma response in the moment, and then they process that quite quickly and it's over and it's just a memory of something that's occurred. And then you might have those two other people, and you might have someone who they were part of that experience and, they just sort of go, oh, well, that happened and I'm okay and I've survived and it's fine. And then it might be days or weeks or months down the track, and suddenly they're struggling to, you know, they're struggling with their sleep and they're having intrusive thoughts, and they're, you know, it shows up a little bit later. And then that fourth person, it might be years before anything ever happens that relates back to that car accident, but that would have been the moment that that changed for that person. So it's, I think trauma is really, really interesting because we all react and respond differently.
Mm.
And very few people come out of it unscathed.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I guess too, you know, we women, we're, I guess, luckily more open to talking about our feelings and our emotions with our friends or, you know, seeking help. But
absolutely,
men are not as open, some of them, you know, because of the way that they've been brought up or the way they feel people will judge them. So do you find that you have as many men reaching out to you for support?
No, I don't. I do have male clients, and it's quite disproportionate. Far more of my clients are female. And what I find really interesting with my male clients, traditionally, it's usually when something in their life suddenly stops working. So they can handle it all up to a point until something happens, and that's that one thing that they just can't move through. And quite often it will be when their relationships are on breaking point. They'll come right when they can't deny it anymore, or they can't ignore it anymore.
Mm.
And it's almost as if life forces them to make a choice or make a decision at that point. And it's really interesting because my male clients are, mind-blowing. They really are. They're quite different to my female clients. They really are. But it's interesting because they have, in general, they have far less understanding of what it is that they've gone through or what they've experienced. Women, as you say, not only do we talk about it, but we tend to research it. We read about what's going on. We like to educate ourselves and to be a little more aware. Whereas, I can't say in general, but what I've seen in my practice is that men are really busy doing what they think they need to be doing. So providing for their families, excelling at work, you know, showing up for their mates and being there and doing that. They don't have a lot of time left for self-analysis or self-development. And so it comes to a point where they realize that something has to give.
Mm.
And then they are so incredibly motivated to fix that situation that I have some of my most phenomenal responses and results are actually from my male clients. And I find some clients in general, and this is just with anyone that's had trauma, some people are really closed off and they struggle to be able to articulate their experience or to be able to trust you enough to share that, to open up and share, because they've got such a history of being betrayed or you know, knowing that they can't trust someone. My male clients tend to do that a little bit differently. By the time they come to me, they are ready and they are, you know, they're no holds barred. So you've almost got to brace yourself a little bit because you know that it's going to be intense. But there is a real beauty in that as well, because it's almost like starting with a fresh blank page. These guys are so open and so willing and so ready to look at what they need to do and what has to change. And it's absolutely beautiful when you go back and you're doing that inner child work, because these guys have never considered their inner children. They've never considered that the way that they are reacting and responding now was programmed into them during those formative years, and that to a degree, they're not just being awful men. You know, they're not just being inconsiderate or doing, you know, doing something that their partner doesn't appreciate. It's not necessarily a conscious choice. So for them, when they can look at this and go, oh my God, that's what this is about. And then they're so willing to actually get in there and do that work. And it is, I don't know, there's something incredibly humbling and beautiful when you see a man who is so willing to break it all down and start again, you know, to totally rebuild or relay that foundation so that they can then create that life that they're really wanting. Because, and again, this is a gross generalization and I don't really want to say it, but the men that I've worked with tend to be guys who on the outside, they look either very gruff or very incredibly successful. So they're either, you know, absolute giants in their fields, or they are, you know, incredibly successful and they're really quite built and, you know, they look very manly. And yet when you get underneath it, they are such broken little boys, and that need to be loved is so profound in the boys or the men that I've worked with. But it's also incredibly beautiful to see those changes, for them to get into that space where they recognize that they actually have a right to put themselves first and that they should be considering what they want in a situation. Because quite often, and it's not the case for everybody, but quite often men are working so hard to do what they think they should be doing and to be who they are supposed to be, that they've never really questioned what they want in that equation and what's important for them. So it's just spectacular to watch these men who are already amazing, but then to watch them blossom into the fullest and most incredible versions of themselves, those truly healed versions, oh, it's spectacular.
Wow. And there is such a need.
Completely.
Such a need. I mean, you just have to look in the media and see the sad stories of, you know, so much male suicide and, you know, and not even just that, it's just what you said about relationships. So, you know, if they're not able to understand why their relationships are dysfunctional, or, you know, then we have children from broken marriages or broken relationships, you know, and it just keeps cascading and going down generations. Yes. So what an important area for our guys. And totally, they, you know, there's still, after all these years, this stigma of guys have to be tough, guys can't cry, you know, they're not allowed to show, they've got to have their mask on, that, you know, they can cope. But then there's that one straw that breaks the camel's back.
Yeah.
And how wonderful would it be if it didn't have to get to that? I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you would agree this is the stuff that we need in school.
Yeah.
I think this great divide between the masculine male and the weak feminine female. We're all the same under the wrappings, aren't we?
Yeah. And I think one of the greatest travesties is that men are disconnected from their emotions. They're not... Mm. It's not acceptable for them to be seen, to be feeling, for them to be moved by something or to have a tear when there's something really, really quite tragic. They're supposed to be stoic and shut that down. And I don't think people realize the damage that that creates because, again, it's probably not entirely the case, but I see so often that the men are actually far more sensitive to situations than we women are. And yet there's that whole sense that that's not acceptable and that's not okay and that's not allowed. So they just shut that down. And I think what an incredible world we would live in if men could truly be who they are in its entirety.
And the ripple effect it will have on their children and their sons.
Absolutely.
That's where we need to go. You know, I'm a real get on my soapbox about this a bit, but to me I just see such a hole in this area. But moving on, I wanted to ask you, when you have a client reach out to you, and I'm sure you've heard some, you know, heartbreaking situations and stories, what is the first thing that you do? How do you gain their trust?
Well, when someone reaches out to me, we do a discovery call. So basically I give them anywhere between half an hour and an hour of my time just to work out if I am the right person to work with them. And really that's just about establishing that connection and really seeing if I am the right person. The vast majority of times I am, but there are some issues that I choose not to work with because of my own personal experience and the boundaries that I have for myself. But it's really important. And one of the reasons that I do that and I structure that into my package is because it's so important for people to feel heard. And if we are rushing through and just trying to do a sales pitch or to analyze, you know, is this going to work? We do that in the background, but we don't need to do that in the foreground. It's really important that people feel that they have, you know, access to you in terms of you are able to actually listen to them. And I think that's really important for people to feel acknowledged, to feel that their story has value. And it's quite often, so it's such a broad spectrum. There will be some people who will jump on a call and they want to tell you all the details of their life as quickly as they can. And those calls can be a little challenging because we do have to sort of step back and go, okay, what are we hoping to achieve from this call? And you know, that's really what we do in the first session when I work with someone. We do a full 1 hour intake and we look at their history and we look at their experiences and we look at that in terms of what could potentially come up and What suspicions do they have? Because quite often my clients have these suspicions, which they've been told all their lives are ridiculous, but they just are persistent. So I go, okay, well, if that's there, let's just be aware that that might come up. So with that discovery call and when people reach out, for me, it's really about letting them know that, yes, I am here to listen to them, and also letting them know that I've created a way of working with clients that provides more support for them. So I don't just do one session and then, you know, a phone call and a follow-up a few weeks later. When I work with people, I work with them over an entire month, and we meet 5 times during that month. So it's a lot of support. So it's important to have the balance between getting in and doing that work, and then also having the time and the space to unpack it and discuss any concerns or any elation that come as a result of that. And just knowing that they have that time and they have that space. And it's really, in many ways, a soft landing space, because sometimes clients will go through and they'll do their sessions, their regressive hypnotherapy, and nothing that comes out of that session is a surprise to them. Other times, every single scene that they go to is a fully repressed memory that they have no conscious memory of. So that is an overwhelming situation where they are dealing with things that are quite, normally they're quite traumatic in and of themselves, which is why the mind has gone back to that moment, because that's what they need to deal with. But on a conscious level, this is a whole lot of information to suddenly be overwhelmed with and to then try to process through. So I like to let people know how I've created that package and why I've created that package, so that they have that little bit of extra support and cushioning should the journey get bumpy.
Wow, that just sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And there's something about you, I've said this to you earlier, there's just this beautiful gentleness about you that is so comforting. And I'm sure you've been told that before by your clients. I mean, working in that field of trauma, I mean, it's, you must hear some things that, you know, are quite heavy. You've got to be really careful not to take on other people's pain. But there's just such a beautiful gentleness about you that I can imagine that really assists your clients in feeling safe and being able to share without judgment. I'm sure you've heard everything by now. I just think you're amazing. And you also mentioned to me that you are not going to be working ongoing one-on-one with people, but you've designed a group or a, I know, what would you call it? What's your program that you have launched?
Well, I haven't launched it yet. I'm still in the production stages with my course, but I am creating a container that will allow people to work through some of these aspects of their trauma independently, because I know that there are people like me who want to do things on their own. And I think it's important to have both options. So as we were discussing, I've always, since I started my practice, I've had this overwhelming sense that I don't have enough hours in the day to support all the clients that would like to work with me. And I've wanted to move into something that allows me to work one to many as opposed to one to one. So I'm creating this, it's an online course at this stage, but there will be live support that goes with that. So group therapy in line with the course that they'll be doing at the same time. And I have 2 names that I've registered, and I'm not quite stuck on one yet. So it will depend what it actually eventually comes out to. But I have rapidly transforming trauma and rapidly transforming childhood trauma. And it will really just depend on which, you know, how much I focus on particular modules and how robust those modules are as to what I choose to call it in the future.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
Thank you.
And I mean, there's only one of you. So,
yeah, unfortunately.
And you do have a life outside of this. You have a family and you're studying. So tell us about your study also, Ruby, because it sounds fascinating.
Oh, thank you. So, yeah, I'm currently pursuing a triple degree. So it's a bachelor's, master's and PhD in natural medicine. And I'm doing that because I think it's so important to be able to combine the not just the mental and emotional healing, but also the physical components that are required as well. So I'm really down the track when I eventually graduate in a couple of years. My goal is to then be creating something that is even more holistic than what I'm creating now, because we know that trauma is trapped in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that we need to do to actually be able to release it kinetically. And there are so many different modalities in addition to hypnotherapy and RTT, which work phenomenally for survivors of childhood trauma. And I'd like to, my goal in the future is to be putting something together that is far more, as I said, more holistic and more complete in terms of looking at all those different aspects and different ways that we can support our mind, body, and soul.
Beautiful. Oh, I can see like an academy.
Oh, look. I don't know about that, but I do have the desire, and I would like to be creating live events so that people can come and experience it for themselves and then be able to choose what they take from that and what they implement. Yeah.
So maybe retreats or speaking events or, oh, well, please share that with me, because I would love to promote anything that you do. I think it's just so important. I think you are amazing. I'm just really grateful that you took the time to talk to me today, because, I mean, I know just from my work when I was doing RTT and especially a lot with women around me in my age group, there's so much stuff that we stuff down, you know, there's so much stuff that needs to come up. And from that, I mean, the great thing from it is that we're freeing the generations after us. We're handing, you know, we're giving that gift to our children and our grandchildren and so on and so on. And it needs to happen. It really does. So I will be sharing all your details. I think the online course just sounds amazing. I wish you all the best with your studies.
Thank you.
And hope that you keep us posted. And now we're going to have fun.
Okay,
because this is me. I like to have fun. We talk about some heavy stuff, and I've got just this really daggy sense of humour. So I'm going to ask you a few questions based on the Actors Studio. I don't know if you've ever watched that show. The end of the show, the interviewer asks a series of questions. You don't know what's coming. Just ask off the top of your head. So number one, Ruby, who is your celebrity crush?
I don't really have one.
Say that. I mean, George Clooney just goes like that. That's all right. You don't have to have one.
I don't really have one. I have like my celebrity dream dinner party list, like the people who I would love to be there. So I would include Reese Witherspoon and, of course, it's got to be Opie, so Oprah's got to be there. And then a couple of people who are less celebrities and more sort of industry focused. So I'm really quite keen on Jenna Kutcher and Amy Porterfield. They're two that I think I would enjoy their company, and I think we would have a great time. That's probably the list of people that I would love to, you know, sit down and have a meal with and a glass of wine.
Beautiful. What's your secret guilty pleasure?
Ooh, hot chips.
Hot chips.
I'm a good little Aussie. Hot chips, yes.
Mine's watching reality television.
I have a second. I love watching those pimple popper videos. They are like amazing.
Favorite food? Oh, what were you, hot chips?
No, hot chips are not a favorite. They're just an occasional, occasional enjoy that. But favorite food, I'd have to say a pork roast.
Favorite all-time movie?
Dirty Dancing.
It's classic. Favorite quote? Do you have a favorite quote?
I'm easily satisfied with The Very Best by Winston Churchill.
Ooh, I think I might write that one out. I like that one.
We have the most fabulous. I'm a book collector, so we have a series of 12 books that Winston Churchill wrote, and they are fabulous.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. What are you most proud of that you've achieved in your life, Ruby?
My children, with my experience, I didn't want to be a mother. I had no interest, and I'd already had cervical cancer and endometriosis before I was married. So I never imagined that I would be a mother. And yet the absolute pride and just the best thing in my world is my two little humans, who are just incredible people. And I'm so grateful to them for so many things, but for giving me that experience of being a mother, proving to me that I was capable of more than I ever imagined.
Oh, I bet you're a wonderful mother.
Oh, thank you.
And finally, if your life was made into a movie, who would you like to play you?
Oh, I don't know her name, but I have a photo of her. Because she's a fabulous redhead.
Ruby's the perfect name for you.
I can't think. She was in the first Twilight movie. She played Victoria, and then they
Oh,
recast someone else.
that's okay. That's
Oh, I
fine.
feel terrible because I can't recall her name, but
Not
she is the
horrible.
most.
So a beautiful,
Oh, I just
stunning
think
redhead.
she is a beautiful, stunning redhead. She's a woman, and the characters that she plays tend to be really powerful and strong and independent. And I just think she would be amazing.
Well, we'll have to find that out
Amazing.
before the movie comes out, won't we?
Yes, we'll have to do some hard negotiations there, I think. But it's such an interesting thing because someone asked me the same question, but in terms of if a book that I was writing was ever turned into a movie, who would I want to play the main character? And she was top and front of my mind.
Right, well, you have to do some Googling.
I will. I feel terrible, isn't it? But that's me. I'm very visual. I see things before I process it any other way.
Perfect. I wouldn't want you any other way. I've just enjoyed talking to you so much. I feel like, we didn't really know each other, but now I feel like I know you a lot more, and it's just been absolutely delightful. And the most important thing is, Ruby, that I know, even if it's just one person that watches this or listens to it, that someone is going to go, wow, that is the person I need to speak to. She is the one that can help me, because I know there's a lot of people out there who have gone through a lot of trauma. And I just applaud you for what you're doing. I think you're amazing. And I'd love to say thank you again. And maybe I'll get you to come back on again one day and have another chat with me.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much, Susie. It has been a pleasure. And I, as well, I hope that anyone, I hope that there's something that's been brought up in this conversation that is helpful for someone out there, because I think everyone deserves to be free.
Absolutely, they do. Thank you, Ruby. Bye for now, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me today on the Untangling Series podcast. I feel absolutely blessed to be on this journey with you. If you would like more details on where to purchase my book, The Untangling, I've popped the link in the notes below. Perhaps you may feel called to work with me one-on-one to support you in your own untangling. I would love that. I offer my services as a coach to walk you through this process in a unique bespoke program created solely for you because you are unique. Another one of my passions is offering my services as a keynote speaker. I do like engaging with others, as you can probably tell. If any of that is of interest to you, You can contact me directly by the links below or head on over to my website at susiedejong.com.au and I will get straight back to you, I promise. I love what I do and I know what my purpose is, to pay it forward and help others untangle and find their own freedom and joy. So bye for now, and I look forward to seeing you next time.